Hello and welcome to I'm Alice podcast, and we're talking about connection, creativity, and how we find clarity through our ever-changing world that we live in. So we're talking about transformation and change. So welcome to this edition of I Am Alice podcast. I hope you enjoy it. Here's Catherine, and she's going to tell you just a little bit about herself and how she came to this subject and to this practice.
Hi, Alice. Nice to see you. Death kind of found me, really, I think. Like most people, I encountered deaths in my life. But then I heard about the possibility of working with people who were dying. And I just never really considered that before, apart from in a medical sense, which is not my thing. And it just landed for me. It just felt like something I was born to do. I immediately was interested. That same evening, I Googled training courses and signed up for my end-of-life doula training, death doula training, to accompany people dying. And then the more I've got into it, the more I found it, it's really such an important part of living. It's changed the way I live. And I think it has the potential to change the way all of us live if we have a better relationship with it.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of my friends can't even talk about death. You mention the word and they say, stop now. I don't want to talk about it. And it's something that we need to talk about more, because it's such a difficult experience to go through. In my experience, I'm sure in yours, it's a difficult process to go through. And I could have done with some knowledge about how I could help the person dying, like say with my father when I was in my 30s. And if you have a good death, then it helps everyone. And including the person. But first, let's tell me a bit about you and your life and what you've been doing in your life, because I'm really interested for people to know about your varied life that you've had. I know you've had a very interesting life living in many countries and doing many different jobs and experiences.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey from being a maths graduate and working in the oil and gas industry to this kind of life that I have now, of much more the life that I want to live and less the life I was programmed to live. I think lots of us have been through that experience. I've lived in four continents. I've raised three kids. I've worked in business. I've run my own business. I'm now really enjoying the freedom of doing the things where my heart takes me, doing the work that feels the most gratifying, the most important to be doing. And writing the book about death and working in the death area has been a really important part of that for me.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading the book. So hurry up and put it out so we can all be inspired by a sacred death. So tell me, what is sacred death? How would you
describe it? Well, I think in the West especially, we've kind of done a number on ourselves around death. We've allowed it to become a very scary, distant thing. If you think back to our ancestors, somebody would have died in the home. They probably would have been cared for in their last weeks and days in the home. Then the person would die. Then they'd still be in the home. Everybody would be involved with washing the body and preparing them, maybe keeping them in the home for a few days until the burial. The kids would be there. Everybody would grow up with that kind of proximity to death. And therefore, things are less scary if you know them and experience them. And you compare that now to this increased medicalization of death that we have in the West, where firstly, we have a society that where you're not even allowed to grow old and get gray hairs, let alone die. It's seen as some kind of failure. We use language like they lost their battle, or they, for the medical industry, every death is a failure. And if we allow death to be run from that point of view, then that's how we feel as well, which makes every death a tragedy instead of the natural end to the arc of a life and the passing on and the circle of life and the generations informing the next generations, all of the value we could get from death gets suppressed, I think, because we're just in this frozen state where either we can't feel anything because we're just numb to it, or we think we're not supposed to feel anything because the last thing we should do is fall apart at the funeral and make a fool of ourselves. We should be all composed and not showing emotion. Or within 3 days, we're supposed to be back at work and perfectly all right when we've just lost a parent or a sibling or a close friend. And all of that emotion hasn't stopped existing just because we don't acknowledge it. It just gets shoved down. And I work with people where that stuff's been shoved down for 30 years, maybe. And only when it's given space to come out can it start to be processed. And the gifts of every death has some gifts for us, some learning, some opportunities for growth. They get lost too if we don't ever face up to it and acknowledge it.
Absolutely.
So for me, I think it's important that it's seen as a sacred moment, and that doesn't need to be a religious thing. I'm not peddling any particular religious point of view. It's just that it's sacred, it's precious. It's like the moment a baby is born. It's a pivotal moment, and how beautiful to be able to just be in that moment and experience it fully in all of our humanity, in all the humanity of the person who's being born or dying, or ourselves being born or dying, and not have that taken over by machinery and bright lights and people shouting and over this earnest attempt to preserve life at all costs, even when the doctors themselves might, some doctors have said to me, you know, they often might feel the kindest thing would be to let the person go. The person's ready to go, but they're under pressure from the system, maybe from the family, to do whatever you can, doctor, just do whatever you can. Exactly. Even if that's a terrible quality of life for the person.
Yeah.
So we've set up this dynamic that it's a failure, so you have to avoid failure, so you have to do everything, instead of taking a more considered, more compassionate view of what's the kindest situation for this person here.
Yes, I agree. I mean, I'm just talking about myself, but my father was in a hospice, and compared to being in a hospital where it's very busy, where you go into a hospital, the energy is very, you can feel it. It's full of fear. It's full of worry. And when he got to go, had the opportunity to go into a hospice, every time I walked in there, because it was quite a few months he was in there, every time I went in there, I felt like it was all lifted. It was, you know, all the people that worked there couldn't do enough. They gave you space. They even allowed us one night when they thought he was going to die to all stay overnight. You know, I felt, I know it sounds a bit strange, but it felt kind of heavenly there, because you could forget about all the worries of everything, or the medical system. And you just could go there. There's a little cafe. You could have a cup of tea and somebody could talk to you. You could pop in and see your dad, or, you know, your person. Well, for me, it was my dad, and just sit at his bed and just, you know, if you wanted to speak, often he didn't want to speak. He just wanted to be there. But obviously lots of people wanted to visit and see him for one more last time and chat and, you know, come in and a little bit more, you know what I mean? Because about them, they're needing this, you know, don't want him to go kind of thing. And yeah, just to spend some time around him and caring for him as well. You know, my brother stayed overnight for 6 weeks, and, you know, we could all be around him. So it was a very peaceful environment for him to go when he was ready, you know, not being like, oh, we'll give him some drugs. I mean, I think they did assist him a bit with pain relief, but it was a very gentle way of going. But still, I didn't have to deal with it. And I didn't really, although I think later I read about Dr. Kubler-Ross and the Kubler-Ross curve. And that really, really helped me throughout life, actually, through any change, knowing where you are in the curve. You know, if you're in shock, if you're in depression, if you're in acceptance, you know, you go through the curve, however it goes and however you're feeling. So that was an invaluable tool for me going through that process. But like you say, you know, within a week I'm finding a new job and I'm working, and those emotions that needed to keep on coming up, I had to sort of suppress them. It's like, oh, you know, I can't really cry at work. You know what I mean? I sort of like lunchtime, I would read the newspaper and then I'd start bawling over something. I was like, oh God, okay, right, you know, let's all pretend. So, I mean, we're both from the UK and we know, you know, how people are in our world. And it's very much suppressing the feelings and stiff upper lip and, you know, just get on with it kind of thing. But, you know, as we know, it's a very unhealthy way of dealing with grief and death, you know.
And the husband movement is amazing, and that has really been an important part of reclaiming death for ourselves and for the people who are dying, and treating it in a different way. And I guess that's also what I'm keen on with the book and with the training courses I do, this idea that death's been colonized and it's now our chance to get it back and say, how do we want it to be? What would be the... It's never going to be a fun event. We're not trying to pretend that. It's always going to be sadness, and there's always going to be loss and a sense of loss and the grief that comes with that. But how can we make it the best that it can be for ourselves and for the dying person?
Yeah. And so what do you cover in the book? What sort of bits can you tell us that you cover to support and to get a wider understanding about how we can support others to have a sacred death? How can we prepare ourselves and, you know, support them through the process?
I think the important first stage, and I was surprised that this was part of the end-of-life doula training, but it makes perfect sense to me now, is our relationship with our own death. Because a surprisingly large number of people pretty much feel they're not actually going to die. You know, death's something that happens to other people. Right. Even though our brain knows that chances are, you know, David Bowie died, so, you know, what chance have the rest of us got? We know that rationally, but we have this kind of feeling that maybe we'll get away with it. And so we don't do the way that, say, in Buddhism, for instance, people would have a lot of relationship with their own death and a lot of time contemplating it. We tend to shy away from that. It's uncomfortable. We don't like it. It's not a popular topic to raise when you're out with your friends for a drink or sitting down to a family meal. People think it's morbid. People think it's depressing. So it's kind of pushed away all the time. So for me, the first important stage and the first part of the book is about understanding our own relationship with death and examining that and how has it shifted over time and what things maybe could we consider changing. And then when we've got that, that puts us in a much stronger position to relate to anybody else who is dying or is grieving. Now, you might have experienced this when your father died, that people are very embarrassed about it. They have their things that they say, I'm very sorry for your loss, and oh, he was such a nice man, or he helped me so much, or their little announcements as they're arriving for the funeral. But then the fourth time they see you in the street after that, they're running out. They don't know where to go. They don't know if they maybe should pretend it never happened and talk about something else, or be all sympathetic, or it's just so much awkwardness around death. And I guess a lot of what I'm trying to say is, let's get over that for our own sake and for society's sake, because we meet little deaths all the time, don't we? The death of a relationship, the death of the end of a job, the end of a beautiful holiday, the end of even just a great evening out with friends. We're constantly having to deal with loss and endings. And we can use all of those, if we choose to not just pack away or run away from the uncomfortable feelings, but hold them and have compassion for them, have compassion for ourselves. Even though that was a lovely event, I'm allowed to feel a bit sad that it's finished.
Yeah.
Or somebody else is allowed to feel a bit sad that something's finished.
So it's all being about the relationship with the self, isn't it, really? It always comes back to the self. You know, I mean, I totally get that. Yeah. I mean, I find it quite awkward when people, you know, someone's died of a friend and because they're so awkward with it as well, maybe, that I don't want to say anything. You know, I'm happy to talk about it and discuss it and keep on, you know, giving support and checking in on them. But it's often because we don't know, we haven't been trained to have that compassion, take that time. And like you say to them once, oh, I'm really sorry for your loss. And, you know, but really it's, and the word sympathy, what do they say? What's the classic thing they say? They say something, I think, is it not sympathy? Maybe it is sympathy. And it's just like that word, yeah. Sympathy. Yes. No, it's like we want actually empathy.
Yeah.
Not empathy, or we want compassion, or we just want to be spoken to, and just, you know, we don't want to avoid it. We don't want it to be the elephant in the room. You know, like you said,
it's interesting that you say we don't know what to do, but which should be fine. Because the compounding problem is we think we're always supposed to know everything. Mm. We're supposed to have the perfect phrase that will make everything better. Are we supposed to make the perfect offer that will help? Instead of just going, I don't know what to say to you, but I'm here. That's all we need to be, is here.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of worked that out. It's like really, you know, yeah. Exactly. And just checking in like you do with friends anyway, you know, it's like, because it doesn't necessarily have to be someone's actual physical death. You know, it can be a life-changing experience where you experience all the emotions of death, but no one's actually died. Like you say, an end of a relationship, divorce. You know, obviously for me, I lost my adopted children, which was a hugely emotional and spiritual experience that, you know, it took me many years to come to terms with. And, but no one really spoke about it. And obviously it was a very real experience for me. And yeah, it was very interesting how we never spoke about it again, kind of thing. We just sort of ignored it. We ignore the situation. Therefore, we're actually ignoring the person and their experience and not acknowledging that they have feelings and they might need to have a hug or just to be present with them. Just to, you know, one thing I felt was about being heard and being able to speak about how I felt, and you know, not in a formal counseling environment, but just as a friend who knows what you've been through, that you can just talk freely about how you feel, because it's difficult feelings. Other people sort of shy away and sort of, oh well, kind of see when you get better, you know, kind of thing.
Are you all right?
You know, with the day, like the
in 3 months.
Exactly.
And,
you know, it takes years. You know, I mean, I remember the first year of my
part of who we are.
But through that, I changed my life when my father died. I went traveling. I really had this like, right, I've really got to live my life. I've really got to go on adventures. I've really got to live. It did make me feel that, I must say. And it gave me a lot of strength. And I was just determined. So you know, a death of my father, he was 66, I was 32. I was just like, well, I've got to live life now. So like you said, there's lots of gifts that come from that experience. And one of the gifts I'll just quickly mention that came to me when I was traveling in New Zealand and I was on my own traveling, I would meet people for a bit and travel with them, but essentially I was on my own. And I was walking through this sort of, through these trees that sort of met at the top. And I was walking through that and I thought, oh, wow, who's going to walk me down the aisle when I get married? Because obviously I had this, still had this idea that I was going to get married, which obviously I did. But, and I was like, oh, because my dad's not going to be there. You know, how can that space be filled? Anyway, it came to me, oh, your brother can do it. And I thought, and my dad will come through him. His spirit is in me, you know, the spirit is in my brother. And also that made me realize that actually anyone that you've loved can't actually leave you. I mean, obviously they leave in the physical sense, but the realization I had was that actually my father can never leave me because he is within me. He's in my heart. And when I realized that, it was a huge comfort to me, because I guess I hadn't thought about it in that way. You just think, oh, he's physically gone. I can't talk to him. I can't hear all his stories. I can't hear his laughter, his silly jokes, or you know, and spend time with him. But I thought, wow, but he hasn't left me. So You know, he's within me and I can talk to him, like to myself, or, you know, journal or whatever. So that was a big realization when I realized that people can't leave you.
And even if you have no spiritual beliefs at all, he's in you, in your DNA, he's in you, in your memories and in your experiences.
Yeah. But for me, that was a really bit of a eureka moment that I realized that. I mean, I guess I'd just been going through all that grief of the loss, and I was very much focused on the loss of my father, that I didn't feel I had enough time with him to get to know him properly. They can't leave you. And I think that's something to really focus on and remember when you're going through grief, is that actually they're in your heart. Anyone's in your heart, whether you're abroad. You know, I was thinking all my family are in the UK, my friends are there, but they're still with me. I can call them up, but they're in my heart. So anything that you carry in your heart is always going to be there. So So what else?
Yeah, and you can always work through some of the challenges as well, because sometimes people die in the middle of a big family argument, for instance, and there can be a lot of regret that person's died and there's been a bad atmosphere or unresolved problems. But I think you can still work on that with their energy, with their presence, what remains of their presence in your life, rather than feel like all is lost and can never be redeemed.
Yeah, and also say when people just die very suddenly. I mean, obviously, I was very lucky. You know, I had a good 6 months before my father died, or maybe 5 months. So I had time to process it. You know, my brother called from Australia. How's Dad? Oh, well, he's dying. Yeah, I know he's dying, but how is he today? You know, it's just, you know, so there was sort of laughter around it, to be honest. But and he did have a good death. But what I wanted to ask you was more, you know, the spiritual aspect. I know you said, obviously, you don't have a religion, but obviously we have souls, you know, I believe, you know, obviously, I think that's general consensus. And that soul obviously leaves the body. And I'm interested if you want to talk a bit more about that, the soul.
Yeah. So as well as doing end-of-life doula training, I also did shamanic training and the shamanic practice called psychopomp, which is ensuring that the spirit, the soul, the energy body of the person has a safe passing as well. It doesn't get stuck. It's another area where we've been sold a particular story, I think, isn't it? That ghosts are scary, bad things. Whereas in my experience, they're just lost or confused or worried about something, need some help, maybe haven't even realized they died if it was a very sudden. So I also get involved with that aspect of death, of helping people who are sometimes people, you know, all the medical staff say, we don't understand why she hasn't died yet. She's ready to go. Her family have all said goodbye. Everybody said it's all right for you to leave, but she's just clinging on and we don't know why. And then I would do this kind of what we call a kind of cleansing and unwinding ceremony with the person. Usually some things might come up, might have been from when she was 3 years old. It might have been from last week. Things that can be healed and released. And then very often within a matter of hours, the person can pass. And also after death, if somebody feels like there's some discomfort still, that there's maybe in the place where the person lived, there's trouble, or maybe there's a sense of someone having too much presence from the person who's died, or might be called haunting, but that's a kind of loaded phrase, so I would avoid it. But the person just seems to be around too much and in a troubled way, and then helping them, doing that same ceremony after their death with their energy body instead of their physical body, and clearing anything that needs to go and helping them release and move on.
And can you do that remotely? Sorry, I'm just thinking, you know, could you do that remotely about the soul? Can you allow, because, you know,
Time and distance are just concepts, aren't they? And I think in the energy world, they don't exist at all. Einstein had views about that it's convenient for us to operate in chronological time and 3D reality, but it's not everything. So yes, it's very it's not really any different for me to work with a physical person in front of me or to work virtually.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, yes, I mean, I know lots of people in the past that, you know, the older people in the, you know, family or, you know, friends of family, and they're very old, they're in nursing homes for very many years. And, you know, their partner had already died and they were on their own. And it's just like, and yeah, you know, I'd go and visit them. And I was thinking, that, it's like, what is stopping them from going? You know, what is it? Because, you know, they get to the point where they really have no value, you know, they're not barely eating, they're not going out, they're not really talking, they're just lying in a bed all day. And which is, you know, it feels very sad that, you know, to visit somebody when they really feel they appear that they don't really want to be here anymore, but they continue on and on. So that's where you could come in and just sort of connect.
At least give them that opportunity, yes. It might be that they're quite content with their inner life and their memories and whatever they're thinking about while they're lying there, apparently not doing anything. Mm. Or it might be that they feel trapped by something. Maybe sometimes people have done something they regret and so they're afraid. If they've been brought up in a religious tradition of judgment and punishment, then dying could be pretty scary and you don't want to get what's coming to you.
Yeah.
If you really believe an issue. Or they may feel that there's somebody, a friend of mine who had early onset dementia, and she was pretty much in that state. She couldn't feed herself, she couldn't talk, she couldn't really move. And she stayed living. And then her son, who was maybe 20 at the time, and had a lot of trouble in his life, came to visit, and he said to her, "It's all right now, Mum, I've got a job as a car mechanic and I like it and they like me and I'm going to be okay." And she died that night.
Wow. Yeah, that's what I was thinking about dementia. And also it made me just think about, you know, when you're unable to, say, walk and you're just lying there, obviously appearing not to have much that you can do in your life. You can't walk, you know, you're sort of stuck in a bed and you're whatever's going on with that person. But it's almost like being a child again, isn't it? It's going back to being, you know, cared for like almost like a baby. You know, I was just thinking that is that sort of like a way of like then you're cared for. So it's like that turning of like when you're born, obviously you're a baby and you're looked after by everyone, and maybe you need a period of that caring environment or something to you know.
Quite nice for someone who spent their whole life looking after other people, couldn't it?
Yeah, I don't know, that's just sprang to mind. It's just that then you get all that care and they feed you and they do everything for you, and maybe that is a preparation to you know, to go to, you know, to rebirth. Okay, brilliant. What about some other things that you want to tell us about the book? So why would we want to buy it and learn about it, or what other secrets, sacred pieces do you have in your book that you want to share? Not all of it, but yeah, how can it
happen? Well, I think some of the one of the things I think is really interesting is how what we can learn from dying people, and less of the trappings of life are important to someone as they're dying. And anyone who's sat with a dying person will have seen that happen, that we fill ourselves up with so much busyness and dashing about and dealing with this and dealing with that and making our lives as complicated as possible, really. And we hold it as a value. If somebody says, "How are you?" "Oh, keeping busy." Like, that's a good thing. Like, it's an achievement. That's what we're supposed to be doing. And watching that falling away of things that don't matter, it's such an important reminder, I think, for those of us who are still living, what actually matters to somebody when they're dying. Being with the people they love, having a moment of pleasure from a piece of favorite food or a sight of a flower, a piece of music, being at peace, being comfortable, having that connection with people. Somebody I'm been working with said to me, if if the fairy godmother showed up and asked me what I wanted, it wouldn't be a longer life. It would be connection.
Yeah.
That's what that person wanted most in the last however long it was going to be. To really feel that.
I think humanity. We're coming to an end now. The Zoom is running out. So if you'd just like to tell us where we can find your book and where we can find you to find out more about sacred death and your book and maybe Instagram, if you'd like.
Sure.
Show the book so we know what the cover looks like. Show us a picture of the book. Do you have it there?
I haven't got the print. It's only gone live on Amazon today and my print copies are in the post. So, but it's almost on Amazon. It's called Sacred Death by Catherine Shovlin. And more about the training and the other things I do, the other death-related services I offer are on my website, which is windsofdiscovery.com.
Brilliant. Oh, well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Catherine. I really enjoyed it. And I hope that this will open up the conversation a bit more about death and sacred death. And also that, you know, we're not going to be afraid and so fearful about it, that we can really learn something about it so we can prepare ourselves and others for when that time comes. But in between time, let's enjoy life. And it's been great talking to you. And I look forward to seeing you back in person next year when hopefully you'll be back in Bali. That would be great.
Yeah. Okay.
Take care. Lovely to talk to you. And let's speak soon.
Thank you for listening today, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like any further information about my work, you can contact me at travelwithalice.com.